in this week's episode of Cold September, the sixth book in the Barney series, The Haunting of Barney Thompson. I wrote the first three Barney books back in the Dark Ages, and they were published in the UK by Piatkis and in Germany by Goldman. Then Piatkis wanted out. I guess the movie wasn't getting made quickly enough for them, which was fair enough because the movie didn't get made quickly enough for anyone. But Goldman kept publishing those books in translation that no one was publishing in the UK. The next three I wrote to send to Germany, where the King was in his counting house, limited edition, and The Last of His Supper. The Germans, they changed the title of every book. Limited edition may sound like it may be a magical lost book, the blind Willie McTell of the Barney series, but it appeared eventually in the UK as the final cut. So in fact, there's nothing magical. It's not a unicorn. It's just a book with Barney cutting hair where people get murdered, and you've already read it. But at the time, I didn't like it much. So when I came to publish the books in the UK, I bumped The Last of His Supper up ahead of it to be book five. And then when it came to do a sixth book, I still disliked limited edition enough that I wrote a completely new novel instead. This was The Haunting of Barney Thompson. You can tell my kids were of a certain age at this point, and that certain age being that they watch Scooby-Doo all the time. So this book is a bit of a Scooby vibe. In fact, I pretty much put the Mystery Incorporated gang in the book, but changed their names. For example, Velma became Selma, which was going to throw even the finest LA lawyer off the scent. The dog had no name and was known throughout as the dog with no name. And this was entirely so I could have the joke at the end where the shaggy character, who was called Bernard, was asked why the dog had no name. And he said he tried to think of what would be appropriate, but he didn't have a Scooby. Sadly, a survey of readers voted that in the top five Barney Thompson jokes of all time. Readers may know that I still use Scooby-Doo references to this day, even though my kids are now in their 20s, so I really ought not to make out like it's their fault. The first draft of the book had a villain going around dressed as a giant fish monster, decapitating people with an axe. I thought the fish monster tied in pretty well with the whole Scoob and the gang vibe. Then, when it came to the big reveal, they'd caught the killer. They went to take off his mask and it turned out it wasn't a mask. It was an actual giant fish monster. I tied it to the nuclear power station just across the water from Millport because there is an actual nuclear power station just across the water from Millport. At the time of writing, that was all I had. It was terrible. I knew it was terrible. I let my wife read it. She told me how terrible it was. Repeatedly, I went back to the drawing board. In the rewrites, the villain was a bloke who went around decapitating people while wearing a Dostoevsky mask. I amused myself with the notion that everyone who saw him coming knew he was Dostoevsky. The idea came from a review of the very first Barney Thompson book, I think in the Sunday Mirror, which said the ending was pure Reservoir Dogs. It was. And the plot, Russian literature fans, that's what they wrote. The plot, Russian literature fans, they wrote, was Crime and Punishment. I tried reading Crime and Punishment specifically for the rewrite of this novel, but decided that if I wanted to finish writing the book before I was 127, I should abandon the Dostoevsky at page 8. The killer also turns out to be possessed by Satan, which may be as far-fetched as a giant fish monster, but in literary terms it worked a lot better. There's a scene where Barney confronts Satan late on a foggy night, and it really brings the story together, in its own terms at least. I still remember the day I wrote that scene in Warsaw and the relief that I'd finally got the book to work, that it wasn't completely shit anymore. Using the Satan character, I then drew on the events of the first couple of Barney books so that The Haunting became something of a reckoning for Barney. The title made far more sense then, and I then continued this theme in the rewritten final cut for the seventh book, after which I was much happier with it. The original German version has a climactic scene featuring the Queen and the Pope, so I think we can all be relieved that doesn't exist anymore. The final cut rounded the series off, and that was that. It ought to have stayed that way, except years and years later, when I was stuck for something to do one afternoon, I wrote the eighth book, and then that happened again, and I wrote a ninth. So here we are, a few random short scenes. You'll note the absence of any of the Scooby-Doo characters, but that's because I can't do the voices. And that's just how it is. The Haunting of Barney Thompson. Early afternoon, the man from the Largs and Millport Chronicle had arrived. No one from the Glasgow Press seemed interested yet. There was a man from the Evening Times in his way, but he'd been waylaid at the Holy Friar just after the Largs turned off in the Beath Road. The others were for now working from a brief report that had gone out in Reuters. A report which had stuck to the facts made the story sound as uninteresting as possible and had failed to mention murder, decapitation or Harrit wars. Barney Thompson stood at the white promenade wall and looked along at the pier. He'd come out for a walk, fresh sea air, a quiet morning in the shop. He had one customer, an elaborate but ultimately unfulfilling Simon Le Bon Leo, while his creative assistant Keanu had been quiet all day. Every now and again the lad had gone out to try to find out more details in the bitter wind, but come up with little other than absurd gossip, much of which he had presented to Barney as truth. Now it was Barney's turn to take a stroll along the promenade. Igor was having lunch with his intended, the town lawyer Garrett Carmichael. Keanu was writing up the latest wild speculation for his blog in the hope that something major would happen and he might become some sort of a thing while holding down the fort in case there were any haircutting emergencies. The crowd in the pier was dwindling. What with it being another slow day in Millport in November, a small assembly had gathered to watch the police investigation. Gainsborough had initially cordoned off the entire pier, but eventually his friends in the audience, and he'd known virtually everyone there, had persuaded him to move the rope closer and closer until the crowd had been within about 10 feet of the boat. In the end, it had been more or less turned into spectator sport, like watching CSI live. Frankenstein had watched the throng encroach, but was of the opinion that if a crime had been committed here, then there was a good chance the perpetrator would be back to take a look. However, police investigation doesn't really reward long-term viewing, so after the spectators began to realise that no murderers were going to be uncovered that day in the pier, and that a murder might not even have been committed, the crowd had dropped off, back to whatever mundane aspect of life it was which held them in this sleepy November day. Barney walked past the small clock tower at the pier entrance. He nodded at a couple of old guys who wandered by. Barney knew all the men in the island, not so many of the women. "Nothing to see," said old Tom Brady. "Took the body away 2 hours ago," said old Tom Ramsey. "But now it'll have been sliced apart, like the Rangers' defence against Juventus in 1995, he giggled. "Away you and shite," said Brady. "Rangers' defence in 95? At least we were in the Champions League. What were you in? The Idiots' League? The Losers' League? I've had enough of your pish. My pish? What about your pish? Enough to flood the Loire Valley." The cut and thrust of radical argument drifted off into the day as they disappeared from the pier. Barney smiled and walked off to the edge of the cordoned-off area. There were only three people left standing now, two still fascinated by events, one leaning against a pole making notes in a small book. There were two men working in the boat that Barney could see, one on deck, rummaging carefully through nets, the other bent down inside the cabin, his back turned. Barney watched them for a second and then approached a man with a notebook. The swell had started to get up and the sea was becoming a little boisterous beneath the pier, sucking noises and the sound of water being drawn between wood. "What's the latest?" asked Barney. The notebook guy gave Barney the once-over, a classical head-to-foot glance, taking everything in. "You're the town barber?" he asked. Barney didn't even begin to wonder. "Barney Thompson," he said, extending his hand, knowing that this wasn't a guy whose hair he'd cut in the past. "William Deco," said the notebook guy. "Friends call you Art," ventured Barney. "Tell me about it." "Might as well have Art stamped on my forehead." "What's with the notebook?" "Logs in Millport Chronicle." "William Deco," said Barney, nodding. "Of course, I read you every week. You're the one." "Always presumed it was a made-up name. Wondered why you didn't just call yourself Arthur Deco or Artemis Deco. Come from a long line of Decos," said Deco. "Family left Spain in 1646. 54, to be precise. We did all right in this country till that bastard Macintosh." The guy, rummaging through the nets, finally stood up and stretched. Looked out to sea, then started wandering around the deck, poking at things with a small stick. "Kind of many abandoned fishing boats to report," said Barney. "First one," said Deco, "and I've been on the job for 33 years. 33 years working for the Largs and Millport Chronicle. Used to think I was going to be someone. The Herald, Scotsman, commentary on Good Morning Scotland, maybe even make the London Times or Newsweek. Used to imagine my byline in the Herald Tribune being read and ignored by people on aeroplanes and in big international chain hotels." He paused. He let out a heavy sigh, filled with all the weariness of the years. "Suppose I was right. I am someone. I'm someone who's been writing for the Largs and Millport Chronicle for 33 years. "Get your story at last," said Barney. "Maybe," said Deco. "Maybe not." "What's the latest?" asked Barney again. having first ventured the question seemingly hours earlier. They took the body away, zipped up in a bag. None of us saw it. Word is there was no obvious cause of death. These two comedians have been in the boat gathering evidence. They're what we call scenes of crime officers, although everyone just calls them CSI now because of the TV show. Barney was familiar with the work of scenes of crime officers, but he wasn't immediately going to fill a reporter in his background. There are two other police here at the moment. They've gone off with the local plot to talk to people, find things out. Two crew members missing. All three of them lived in the island. The trawler was discovered by three old guys out in a yacht. They came in with a boat, gave statements, and they're gone. At least they'll have a tale to tell at dinner in the next few weeks. Deco paused and looked through his notebook, seeing if there was anything else to have note. Face a blank, then a small nod. The boat only usually went out for one night at a time. Got that from a guy who was standing where you are right now. But he went out three nights this time. They'd reported him that he'd been away longer, but no one knows why. At least, no one I've spoken to yet. Barney looked back along the front of the town, Stuart Street quiet in the early afternoon sun. Along the promenade, the garrison building, newly refurbished and gleaming past Newton Beach and the Crocodile Rock, and beyond to Kames Bay, where you could see his house, sitting in amongst the neat row of large Victorian homes at the east end of the town. The seagulls dipped and swooped and cried. The sea showed increasing signs of life. "When'd you have to file?" asked Barney. 3 days, said Deco. "Plenty of time for things to develop." Deco muttered something low and dismal. "Maybe the editor will want to bring out a special Millport Trawler Mystery Edition," said Barney. Deco wrote something else down in his notebook, as if Barney had just given him an idea. The pages turned away so that Barney couldn't see what he was writing. "I am the editor," said Deco. Barney smiled, turned away from the bitter wind and began walking slowly back down the pier. Not long after 2:15 in the afternoon, the shop was quiet, no customers. Igor had gone off for the afternoon, brought into service his husband and father-to-be to collect the gently vomiting Ella Carmichael from school. Barney and Keanu had sat in silence for a while, occasionally breaking into sporadic bouts of curiosity about life and the day, before Barney had offered Keanu the chance to head out into the afternoon to do a little bit of investigative journalism himself. Search around, see what he could find out about the missing trawlerman. Barney was in his own. The day outside was cold, the shop was warm. He'd been sitting in the middle chair looking out at the day. Then the quiet of the afternoon and the warmth of the shop began to insinuate itself into his lazy bones, and slowly he drifted off into a comfortable afternoon snooze. 2:17. The door to the shop opened and Barney was brought suddenly from his slumber, his head snapping up to the side. So instant it looked like he'd been sat poised, waiting for the next customer. He stared at the man for the second, a young guy, mid-twenties maybe, head mostly obscured by a great mass of brown hair and beard, which made it slightly harder to tell his age. Barney still had that peculiar sensation of being drawn suddenly from deep sleep, not entirely sure where he was, not entirely sure what was going to come next, a vague look of confusion.
"Haircut?"
asked the guy. Barney shook his head, the cobwebs washed away, sudden instant clarity in the benefit of 20 minutes power sleep. He practically leapt out of his chair. "Of course," he said. He smiled. "All I could do with it." The guy laughed, a lovely, gentle sound. He removed his jacket and sat down in the warm chair and Barney had just vacated. "Toasty," he said. Barney flung the cape round the lad with a glance outside of the day through the broken window pane. The glazier booked for the following morning. The afternoon still dull grey, the colour of his dreams. "What would you like?" he asked. The man hesitated, then shrugged. "I was looking for a Bruce Willis Die Hard. What do you think?" Barney caught his eye in the mirror. "It's a bit of a departure from the general prevailing shagginess you've got going on there." Bruce Willis smiled. "It's just, you know, this might sound stupid." "Go on, I'm no judge. I've been at sea for a while, I'm done with that now. I just want, you know, a new life, you know what I'm saying? I want everything to be different. New start, that whole thing." Barney felt the shimmer of foreboding. Across his shoulders, the back of his neck. Although Millport was on a small island, it's not a seafaring community. He'd gone a year and a half in this place without coming across anyone who worked their living from the sea, with the exception of Duker and the lads. "I know what you're thinking," said Bruce. "I'm just like one of those women who get dumped by their boyfriend. First thing they do is head down to the hairdressers and get their napper cut and eat a bob. I know what it looks like, but it's different, really. It's not about women." Barney started running his hands through the guy's hair, gauging the thickness, working out where he was going to start. "What's about then?" asked Barney. Looked into the guy's eyes again. Dark, blue-grey. Bruce Willis lowered his eyes. He stretched his fingers out and stared at his hands. "You ever walk away from the past?" he said. "Forget things you've done. Not sins, necessarily. I'm not talking about divine misdeeds. Sometimes, though, you just want to run away." Bruce Willis was still studying his hands. Barney looked at his own hands. Soft skin, slowly aging. Short nails, but neat. A couple of tiny strands of hair stuck beneath them. He flexed his fingers, studying the skin as it tightened and relaxed. Suddenly felt the need to wash his hands. Was it just the hairs beneath the nails, or was there something else he needed to wash away? "It's what inside that matters, isn't it?" said Barney distractedly. Bruce Willis glanced up and caught Barney looking at his fingers. "There's no escaping that," he said. "No, I don't suppose there is." Barney dragged himself away from his hands and looked Bruce Willis in the eye. "However," said Bruce, "you make the illusion of change, and sometimes the illusion, if you try hard enough, can impact on the reality. So I'll hum a Bruce Willis Die Hard and see if it makes any difference to when I walk out of the shop." "Okay," said Barney. "I take it then you also want to lose the beard." "Go for it. I might ask you to shave it down to a bit of a goatee, see how that looks. But more than likely, we'll just be getting off the train along the way to take a look before getting back on again and completing the journey." "I hear you," said Barney. "I'm no fan of sculpted facial hair, I have to admit, although I am occasionally obliged to administer it. Mostly to women, of course." They smiled at the joke. Barney ran his hand down the side of the guy's beard to scope the job. He was going to need heavy barbatorial equipment for this, the likes of which he didn't usually keep out front. "You're going to look pretty baby-faced once it comes off," he said. Bruce Willis shrugged. "Not for long. And maybe that's part of the whole thing. Take a few years off. I can imagine they never happened." Another look exchanged. Barney felt the shiver again, stronger this time. "I just need to go and get the lawnmower," said Barney, the joke having been in his mind before they returned to whatever peculiarity of conversation it was that haunted him about this man. Bruce Willis nodded and scratched his beard. "I was expecting you to charge me triple," he said, smiling. The conversation seemed all over the place and Barney couldn't pin it down. He turned away and walked towards the back of the shop. Did he really need anything in the other room, or was he just going in there to break the spell, to wash his hands? "You ever kill a man, Barney?" Barney froze. He felt the words as much as heard them, and then felt the very real, violent shudder which racked his body. He turned quickly. Outside the shop, a single gull cried mournfully, the doleful sound cutting through the silence, a lament to the sins of Barney Thompson's past. Inside, the shop was empty. Empty save for Barney Thompson, a barber, looking lost and confused. The seat was empty. The customer was gone. Gone, that is, if he'd ever been there in the first place. Nellie Johnson was painting. Everyone should have a hobby. Just before 11:30, Nellie didn't do mornings, working to a different clock from most people. Up at 2 in the afternoon, retreated to bed around 6 a.m, 8 hours of sleep. Nellie was old, never sure that she needed that much, but usually found it hard to get up to face the day. In winter, she saw 2 hours of light. Her daughter, who lived in Kilmarnock, thought her mother was weird, used to smoke rolled-up newspaper, had thought about getting her committed. Really, she just wanted to sell the house and take the money. Hoped that her mother would die soon and save her the effort of having her put away. She was about to get her wish, although Nellie's will would ultimately disappoint her. There was a noise in the kitchen, a stumble, the low whisper of a curse. Nellie looked round. She was in her front room, bathed in artificial light, painting a curious scene of gothic depravity, goblins, blood, naked witches. Nellie pursed her lips, an intruder. No skip of the heart, though she did briefly wonder if she should open the curtains in the room she was sitting in, so that whatever was about to happen would be in full view of the street. Not that there'd be too many people abroad in George Street at this time of the evening. The kitchen door creaked. Nellie gripped her paintbrush. "Doesn't sound like much, but bury one in your eye and see how much it'll upset your equilibrium." She'd have thought, the sort of thought she didn't take much for her to have, stuck the second and third fingers of her right hand into the red paint and drew two lines in either cheek, next into the blue, then she'd a purpley streak across her forehead. Footsteps in the hall. She contemplated a brush in each hand, decided to stick with just the one. A free hand is worth 1,000 swords. Isn't that what the ancients used to say? Probably not, but it's the kind of thing the ancients in Nellie's world would have said. She looked at her painting and noticed a tiny detail amiss in amongst her epic triangular exposition of sapphic Batcave death rock. Nellie! She didn't recognise the voice, muffled. She leant forward and touched up the small area of dark grey in amongst the tangle of arms and legs. The door to the sitting room was pushed open, and a man walked into the room. He stopped in the doorway, and Nellie looked round from behind her painting. An old man, dressed all in black, absurd hair, thin in top, long down to his neck, a long, thin beard. She shuddered for a second, thinking it might be Mr. Johnson returned from the grave. Then she realised that for the kick-off, he didn't look anything like Mr. Johnson, and secondly, it was a mask. It was just a guy in a mask, more or less what she'd been expecting from the moment she'd heard the noise in the kitchen. Consequently, what with her face made up in the manner of a regulation 1950s Hollywood Native American, the intruder got more of a fright than Nellie. Bloody hell, he muttered through the latex before managing to compose himself. Who the fuck are you? Demanded Nellie, clutching her paintbrush, but not rising from her chair. Are you from the government? You hear about the mince pies? Nellie, said the guy. Holes for his eyes and mouth. He was clutching an axe, the same brute of a weapon which had done for the still undiscovered Ward Bracken the previous evening. Big fucking brains in you, said Nellie. Bugger off. The guy moved forward. Still, strangely, there seemed nothing particularly menacing about him, despite the axe. What's with a mask? Said Nellie. You look like a drooling old gipper, all incontinence pants and falling asleep in your soup. You'd know about that, he said. Nellie was getting mad, not scared. She stood up and raised the paintbrush above her head. Lips curled in a snarl, the old man hesitated before the kill. You only say what this is about before you kill me? Are you too pusillanimous even for that, you stupid prick? Duke aimed at his right eye. I wanted to murder for my own satisfaction, said the old man, and she could sense his smile and the sweat behind the plastic. Oh, for God's sake, muttered Nellie. Here we go, quoting Russian literature, pish, where you can go and stick your dust. The axe fell swiftly, moving through the air with the romantic swoosh of a cricket bat, swinging through the line of the ball and hitting a beautiful boundary back over the bowler's head. Nellie's head spun into the air, blood spraying in a mathematically precise parabola around the room, bounced off the painting and fell with a thump onto the floor. Eyes open, still angry. Her body stayed inert in the seat for a second, then the arm fell to the side, and the movement toppled the body over and it fell heavily onto the floor beside the head. He stood over the body, making sure she was dead. You never knew with Nellie. Then he straightened up, chest thumping with the excitement of the kill. He wiped the blade of the axe in the curtains. Then almost as an afterthought, he walked quickly across the room, turned out the light and then back and pulled the curtains to the side. He wanted the body to be discovered in the morning, still a little disappointed that his first work of atrocity had not yet been spotted. He wanted the town to get on with the business of being in ferment and turmoil. Another few seconds, a last glance around the room and the dim light from the street, and then he turned and walked quickly back through the house to the kitchen. Barney walked on right around the island, past the aquarium and Keppel Pier and the Lion Rock. The wishing well, the marina and the ferry landing slip, the small column at the far end looking north where Frankenstein had first encountered Fred and the gang, on round the small bay back south past the old fish farm, which had once famously been converted into a soccer stadium or something live on BBC, the twisty back roads towards the Indian Rock, looking out at the tired grey seas over to Bute and the hills of Arran, over the small hump and down into Fintry Bay, mid-November, Caffey was still open. A long, slow walk, and by the time he reached Fintry, he was ready to sit down. He debated the element of human company that entering would involve, and then walked wearily up the steps and inside. The place was busy with tourists. He stopped for a second and looked over them all, people wrapped in thick jackets, gloves and scarves and hats discarded. Where have all these people come from, he wondered. He'd walked slowly around the island and barely seen anyone. He walked to the counter, the gloom of the world on his shoulders. He knew the small woman standing behind, frantically rushing around, resupplying the shelves of sandwiches which had been unexpectedly depleted. "Busy?" he said. "Tell me about it, Mr. Thompson." Then she looked conspiratorially around the clientele and leant forwards, her voice hushed. "Gloaters and sightseers. Here because that old woman was murdered. Then they came round here because you can look across the water to where the trawler was found. They just want to catch a glimpse of an actual police investigation. Police should sell tickets, I'm telling you. They've been minted. Really, it's terrible. But then, who's to say, you know, people want what they want. It's like reality TV right on your doorstep. Why sit at home with a cup of tea watching endless adverts on ITV or the BBC telling you how wonderful they are every 30 seconds when you see the real thing in action? But then, we're talking about a woman's life here, aren't we?" A pause. Barney wondered if she was finished and whether he'd now be able to get his order in. "You can tell I'm a Gemini," she said. "Both sides." "Thought that was Libra," said Barney. "Maybe it was my mum who's Libra. Can I order something now? What were you waiting for?" Barney nodded ruefully and looked into the glass cabinet to see what was on offer. The food was lined up, each item appropriately labelled. "Decapitation donuts, £1.75. Murder muffins, £1.75. Slaughter scones with genocide jam, £1.50. Execution eclairs, £2.55. Nelly Nosh soup with bludgeon bread, £3.75. Bloodbath broth, £2.05. Barney looked at Meg Braintree. "Just, you know, giving the public what they want," she said defensively, arms folded. "I'll just have a cappuccino, please," said Barney. "Would that be a carnage cappuccino or a regular?" Barney looked deadpan across the counter. "Regular," she ventured. He nodded. She fussed away to make the coffee. Barney turned and looked round at the crowded cafe. A lot of gloaters and sightseers, right enough. As he tuned into the room, he could hear various conversations, excited chatter about the murder of Nellie Johnson and the mystery of the missing trawler crew. Some within there even heard mention of the incredible Captain Death. The door opened and our couple entered, agitated in discussion, a bustle of coats and scarves and hats and gloves. He was drawn to them, this middle-aged couple, over all the others. "Can you no remember that?" said the woman. "Was that all the papers?" "Nope," said the man. He looked bored. He looked like he needed a cup of trawler tea and a savage sandwich. "You're a total idiot. I don't believe you sometimes. Can you no remember anything that happened before yesterday? I'm like that." They bustled up to the counter and stood next to Barney, perusing the various murder-related foods on offer. "I can remember the Scotland team that lost 1-0 to Brazil at Hampden in 1973, said the guy. "Went with my dad." "Went with your dad? Like you've never mentioned that before. Where are you when you're sitting watching the TV? Do you completely tune out the rest of the planet? Do you completely tune me out?" "Cudgel cake looks tasty," he said. "It was all over the papers. Don't remember." She glanced at Barney, who was standing next to them, looking at them strangely. Why do people make themselves live with someone else who annoys them as much as this? That's what he was thinking, a thought in itself overwhelmed by the odd feeling he had about them, that somehow this absurd conversational labyrinth referred to him. "Do you remember that?" she said sharply to Barney. "Are all you men muppets of equal order?" "I remember the muppets," chipped the guy in from the back. "Remember what?" said Barney. "That thing a few years ago. It was in all the papers. The barber. He killed the two lads in the shop. His mother was a serial killer. All that stuff. I cannot believe I'm the only one who remembers that. Everyone thought the bloke had died, but the rumour is he's down here, in Millport. I just heard someone talking about it. They couldn't remember his name either." Barney stared at her. He stared through her. He'd lived so many years when he hadn't had to think about this, and now from every angle it was coming back. "You're just another glicky idiot, aren't you?" she said. Barney looked into the eyes, but he wasn't seeing her. He was seeing Willie Henderson slide in a puddle on the barbershop floor, reaching out to grab him as he fell forward. He could feel the scissors in his hand accidentally thrust deep into Willie's chest. He could feel the warmth of the blood which spurted out over his hand and wrist. "You're the barber here, Mr. Thompson, aren't you?" said Meg Braintree, joining the melee. "You know if there were any murderers working at the shop. What about that little hunchback fella? He's a bit suspicious looking." Barney glanced round at her quickly, sudden annoyance coming with the ugly feeling of the waves of the past. "Igor's fine," he said. "Leave him out of it." "He's short and he can't talk. There's obviously something going on. Barney gave her a look which burrowed deep into her head. Another sharp glance at the woman who'd started off this latest intrusion from the distant past. And then he walked quickly from the cafe, pushing the door open roughly and almost running down the steps and back down to the road. The vultures were circling. The woman who'd started this new incursion into Barney's past watched him go and then rubbed a pensive hand across a hairier than acceptable chin. "Thompson," she said. "Her name rings a bell." Meg Braintree and the husband looked at her expectantly, but eventually she shook her head and the thought that was so close to emerging was once more subsumed in the collective crap of any human mind. "Think I'll have a blood-fest bagel," said her husband to fill the gap. Then he added, "and some ice-picked tea," as the opportunity presented itself.